Coming up on Golf Today, Scotty's back on the PGA Tour in his native Texas with a major on deck. Should he be the favorite both at the Nelson and the PGA at Oak Hill? And she's the real MVP from the International Crown. Arya Jutanagarn joins the show. How did Team Thailand take down everyone in the city by the bay? And Cameron Kucher is the 15-year-old son of Matt Kucher and just might join his old man in the U.S. Open. How is that even possible? Find out next on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
Golf Today on a Wednesday, Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch. Golf Week magazine feels like another big-time part of the schedule. The AT&T Byron Nelson followed by the second major championship on the men's side.
Yeah, you've got guys playing out in Dallas who are trying to find some form, Damon. You've guys, some of whom are sitting at home trying to stay hot for next week at Oak Hill. And then you've guys just trying to find health. Jordan Spieth being the worrisome one in that category right now.
No doubt about it. Speaking of next week, the field is set for the PGA Championship. 18 LIV golfers in the field of 155 next week. The same number of LIV players, by the way, that played in the Masters last month. And you see some names that you saw last month, likes of Brooks Koepka, Phil Mickelson in the field. What do you make of this, and maybe what's at stake for some of these players next week?
These are all pretty much what you'd expect given the established criteria. The only oddity in there, in a way, I guess, is Paul Casey. And there has been a habit in the past of inviting people who had played on the previous Ryder Cup team. And Paul Casey might be said to be there on that criteria. The PGA of America has not responded yet to inquiries about why Paul Casey is there, what criteria he's invited by. But there were also four other guys who played on that Ryder Cup team who could be said to have met that criteria, which is Bernd Wiesberger, Lee Westwood, Ian Poulter and Sergio Garcia, none of whom were invited. In fact, there are seven LIV players who are ranked higher in the world rankings than Paul Casey, who's 131st right now, who weren't invited, starting with Cameron Tringali, who's just outside of the top 100 at 103. So he's the only oddity in there at all. But it's not in any way surprising that this is the number what it is. It's going to be interesting going forward, even if you get to sort of not even the Open Championship this year, but by the time you get around to the Masters next year, it becomes tougher and tougher for LIV players without official world golf ranking points to make their way in. It's no longer going to be based on what are increasingly legacy performances. And that's what it is right now. These guys are going to have to play well in these big events and finish within certain criteria that will then guarantee them events or invitations into other majors.
Top 15 players, if you win, obviously, or if you finish in the top 15 at the PGA Championship next week, you would get into next year's PGA Championship. Well, the PGA Tour in Texas this week at Craig Ranch, where players are getting ready to compete in the tournament named after an all-time Texas golf legend. Coverage of the AT&T Byron Nelson begins tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern time. Let's take a look at some of the highest-ranked players in this field this week. There's the world number two, Scottie Scheffler, won the Players' Championship, won in Phoenix. That went back-to-back in Phoenix. Tyrrell Hatton's had a fantastic year. Tom Kim looking for some heat, as is Hideki Matsuyama. Tom Hoagie took a couple of weeks off and back on the PGA Tour this week. And speaking of the world number two, played his college golf for Texas, had a couple of wins, including the Big 12 Championship as a freshman in 2015 when he was named the Big 12 Conference Newcomer of the Year, was a three-time All-American, helped the Longhorns reach the match play portion of the NCAA Finals as a freshman and sophomore, making his fifth start in this week's event, has never missed the cut, the best finish of T15 in 2022. More on the happenings this week. Let's welcome in our own George Savarikas from TPC, Craig Ranch. Hey, George.
Hey, Damon. Yeah, it's pretty crazy to think that Scottie Scheffler's never posted a top 10 here at the AT&T Byron Nelson. Been a minute since we've seen him on the PGA Tour. Had that stretch where he finished T10 in his title defense at the Masters, and then just outside the top 10, T11 at the RBC Heritage. Just caught up with Scottie Scheffler a little bit ago, asked him how impactful the break was, as well as just his connection and why this is such an important event to him year in and year out here at the AT&T Byron Nelson.
Yeah, it was good. I tend to get pretty tired after the majors, and so having that little bit of a break was nice once Hilton Head got done, and it was a busy start to the year, and so it was a good little reset.
What went into the decision to take last week off and have this on the schedule?
Yeah, so I want to support the events that are close to home. You know, the Byron means a lot to me. They gave me a spot when I was in high school here at this tournament, and so it's important for me to come back here and play. And yeah, that was pretty much the decision.
Since first playing here back in 2014, and I remember talking to you that week when you were a 17-year-old teeing it up here, what's it like now growing into where you're the headliner, you're the highest-ranked player in the field, and you're the local guy?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's definitely a lot of fun playing in front of the home crowds. And, yeah, I don't really know how to describe it. I remember playing here in high school, and it felt like a really big deal, and at the time it was, and it's still a big deal for me to come here and show up and play, and so I'm excited to be here and looking for a good week.
Looking at your results in the PGA Tour since the Worldwide Technology Championship at Mayakoba, you've had 11 starts, top 12 or better each and every single time. When you hear those numbers and that level of consistency, what comes to mind?
Well, I'm glad that I've shown some consistency. That's what I think I'm searching for always as a player, and when we're practicing and working on stuff, I'm trying to get more consistent. And so to have those results is good, and I'm fortunate to have a couple wins as well. And so all I'm doing is just trying to keep myself in a good position and see what happens.
Last year at this point of the season, you had 4 wins in a major. You ended the season 4 wins in a major, but PGA Tour Player of the Year. You already have a couple wins now. What can you draw on from last year as you try and play your best golf at this point of the season going forward?
Yeah, trying to manage my energy levels. I think that's why I took a bit of a break. Had a nice, you know, few weeks off, just because the season's a grind. And now, especially with the tournaments having so many good players, it feels like you're playing a major almost every week you show up. And so it's a little bit of a different feeling, but as a player, it's a lot of fun getting to compete against the best guys pretty much or nearly every time we tee it up.
Final question. I remember talking to 17-year-old Scotty Scheffler. He didn't quite have the beard.
I got a little lazy.
But if you told him that, hey, 9 years from now, you're going to have 6 wins, a major, be world number 2, what would you think of the journey?
Yeah, it's been a pretty wild ride. If you would have told me that back then, I probably would have told you you're crazy. You know, I was just a high school kid. I was just trying to play some good golf, and I didn't really know where it would take me. I was just always liked practicing and playing, and so it was just something that I did. And so golf's treated me well for a long time, and I'm very blessed to be out here. And yeah, looking forward to this week.
That's pretty crazy. I think Scotty Scheffler had a top 25 appearance in his very first start here as a high schooler back in 2014. I was joking with him when we wrapped up the interview. The question, the taboo word that guys want to avoid this week if they live locally, ticket requests. How many is Scotty dealing with? And he said, fortunately, my wife Meredith handles a lot of that. It hasn't been bombarded too bad. And you know, historically, with when Jordan Spieth has played in the event, obviously missing it this year because of injury, or was even talking with Brandon Wu, who lives in the area. He's another local guy. You know, friends and friends extended are going to be reaching out as we get into the weekend here at the AT&T Byron Nelson. Damon.
Scotty Scheffler seems to handle everything like water off a duck's back. Great reporting from George Savarikas in Dallas, Texas. Take a look at the first round tee time for Scotty Scheffler. He will be late, early, alongside the 2-time defending champ K.H. Lee and Jason Day, who got his first PGA Tour win at the Nelson back in 2010. And whenever I hear Scotty Scheffler and see him, it's almost like, oh, yeah, Scotty Scheffler, like, one of the best players in the game, maybe the only man who can stop Jon Rahm from winning the PGA Tour Player of the Year. There's still lots of golf yet to be played, but I almost feel like he, even now, floats just a little bit under the radar.
He's kind of like a pickpocket in that you don't notice he's there, and then Sunday he's made off with your wallet and the trophy. And George referenced his consistency there, and it doesn't really do it justice just to point out that in his last 12 worldwide starts, his worst finish has been a tie for 12th. But in his career, Scotty Scheffler, as we look forward to Oak Hill next week, he's played 12 major championships in his career. He's missed one cut, so now we're down to 11. Of those 11, he's been in the top 20 10 times, 7 times in the top 10. And the only time he missed the top 20 when he made the cut, he was tied for 21st. This guy is there all the time. He puts himself in event after event after event. He's there waiting around, and you tend to win a lot of tournaments if you just put yourself in position. You know, that's a lesson you learn from the careers of Jack Nicklaus and a Nick Faldo and guys like that who were there all the time, put themselves in the mix for when others were going to fail. And he's also capable of the runaway win. We've seen that as well at various tournaments, not least the Players' Championship and the Masters last year.
Yeah, a magician never tells you you know, how he or she goes about the magic tricks. A chef never really tells you the ingredients that make the meal. And I think Scottie Scheffler is very much cut from a similar cloth. So you have to go to people close to him, like a John Fields, the coach at UT where he played, who told me years ago that Scottie has a short game that is second to none. Or his current coach, Randy Smith, who says that the fire burns and that he is highly competitive, even if we won't really see it. You know, we're not going to see him, for the most part, slam a club. We're not going to see him give necessarily the best sound bites from time to time. But that's how he goes about his business, and his expectations in this game are as high as anybody who has 14 clubs in his bag.
And the numbers are backing him up. I mean, he leads the tour right now in strokes gained tee to green, number one. He's number one in greens in regulation on the PGA Tour. He's number one in strokes gained off the tee. The only little wary statistic in there is his putting. He's 99th on tour in putting. He's kind of streaky in that category. But he's streaky good a lot of the time. I mean, if you're a little occasionally wobbly with the short stick and you're still finishing no worse than tied 12th in your last 12 starts around the world, and he's competing against the world's best every time he goes out there. He's not taking on a lot of weak fields out there. This field this week may actually be the weakest field Scottie Scheffler's faced all year. And he's still putting himself in that mix all the time, even with something that on paper doesn't seem like his strongest weapon.
And as you've said, has shown remarkable comfort in the major championships young in his career. And not every player does that, not even a great player. Max Homa has struggled to find himself in contention in the majors. And Scottie Scheffler seemingly in contention every single time they're playing for a big trophy.
He plays this game in sunshine, Damon. There's no dark patches in Scottie Scheffler's game right now. Well, up next, we're going to talk to the only man in golf who admits to being more of a basket case than me or Damon. Robert Dameron will join us to talk about his win at the Byron Nelson and how he's dipping his toes back into competitive golf.
Back on Golf Today, great event this week on the PGA Tour honoring the life of Byron Nelson. Nelson won 52 times on the PGA Tour, sixth on the all-time list. Nelson was part of the inaugural World Golf Hall of Fame class in 1974. This event is one of just two on the PGA Tour to be named after a professional golfer, the other being the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Take you back to 2001. Good pal Robert Dameron beat Scott Verplank on the fourth hole of a playoff to win the AT&T Byron Nelson, record his lone PGA Tour victory. Quite the win for Dameron in a field that included five of the top seven players in the world, including some guy named Tiger Woods.
And that is the cherry in the bio of Robert Dameron, who was also a three-time All-American at the University of Central Florida and won the 2008 Athens Regional Foundation Classic on the Corn Ferry Tour. And Robert Dameron joins us now, one of the few men in golf who actually has visited the dark places that we have with this game, Damon. Oh. Robert, I want to take you back to that victory. You had Tiger in the mix, Nick Price in the mix, David Duval in the mix, but over the last four or five holes, it was pretty much you and Scott Verplank going head-to-head. Did that make it a little easier for you to focus down the stretch for that first win when it was a match play situation against one guy?
Actually, you're right. I did... it was a match play event at that point, essentially, because the other guys were in and you know, Verplank and I kind of pulled away the last few holes, but frankly, I turned it into a match play event on the first tee. I knew I couldn't handle what Tiger was going to throw at me if he played good. I was nervous. I hadn't played the final group yet of any PGA Tour event on Sunday. So what I did is, and how I took my mind off of everyone else was, I've just got to beat Verplank. If I don't beat Verplank, I can't win anyway. So I treated it as match play. I did not watch the leaderboards at all, although you could hear what was going on with Tiger, which means you know that he's doing something special up there, and that's got me quaking in my boots. But I just knew if I did my job, things would turn out pretty good. And fortunately, they did. In hindsight, you know, I would call at the time, I would call not looking at the leaderboard strategy. In hindsight, I think it's just pure raw fear that I would look up and see, you know, the greatest player in the world with Tiger held all four majors at that point. So if he starts charging up the leaderboard, you know, I was going to be helpless. So I just didn't want to look.
Robert, he shot 63. This is the height of Tiger mania, as you mentioned. Did you put earplugs in? Did you talk to your caddy a little bit more? How did you ignore all the noise that was going on the golf course?
You can't. I just try to shut it off, but there was a roar for everyone else, and then there was a Tiger roar, and you knew what Tiger was doing, and I knew he was doing something special. The good news for me was he just played a flat first three rounds. He didn't do a whole lot and was a little too far back to catch us, thank goodness, because he was, he's always been so great, but he was the absolute height of his powers of all time there. Like I said, Players Champion, all four majors at that moment. So you put little old me from Eastern Kentucky out there against Tiger Woods, probably the greatest of all time, and I've got no chance. So thankfully he was flat the first three rounds, and I just kind of steered away from wondering what he was doing. I couldn't help what he was doing. Eventually he ran out of holes. That was the saving grace. He just didn't have any more holes to chase us down.
Well, little old you from Eastern Kentucky ended up experiencing one of those great things in the world of golf back then when Byron Nelson's there to greet you behind the 18th hole after the victory. What did he say to you after the win?
He was Verplank's a Dallas guy, so they were kind of pulling for Verplank. Now, Byron Nelson's never going to say that to me, like, hey, oh, I'm sorry that you won and Verplank lost, but they were pulling for Verplank just a little bit, but he was super gracious. I don't remember specifics what he said, but I got a couple nice letters from him afterwards. Congratulations on winning my tournament. Can't wait to see you again. I've got those framed at home, and all the stories that you hear about this gentleman, this wonderful gentleman, they're all true. He was absolutely the nicest guy alive. He and his wife Peggy were super sweet. Peggy's from Toledo. My wife is from Toledo, so we've got some connection there, and Peggy took to her and me both. So it's super, super fortunate. One of the highlights of my life, getting to, hold the trophy with him on the last green there.
Buddy, it was a big moment for you, but in what ways did the golf get harder for you after that victory as the expectations start to grow?
Expectations is part of it. You don't expect to be on tour and never win, so I felt like I was going to get a win somewhere, something was going to strike, but then you want to justify it. You want to come back and say, that wasn't a fluke, I can do that again. And there's a little extra pressure there. And remember, this is 2001, and this is in the period where the golf ball really started to change things. The Pro V1 had come out, I guess, October the previous year, and the ball started getting longer. And for some reason, the way I hit it, the spin rate that I put on it, didn't translate to more distance. And all of a sudden, everyone else was getting longer. So now I'm trying to push it. I start driving it actually worse while watching these young guys come out and fly at 300 and hit three woods well past my best drive. And it got a little, dicey for me because of that. I tried a little too hard with the driver. I was always a good driver, but I got a little yippy afterwards trying to be, an excellent driver of the ball. And some reason I just didn't get anything out of that new golf ball, and everyone else was passing me out.
Was that yippiness why you walked away from the tour, Robert? It's been 10 years since you played a PGA Tour event. And this game, by your own admission and conversations we've had, has taken you to some pretty dark places.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you've seen some guys that get the yips with their driver or their chipping. And Baker Finch, I guess, is the poster child. I was never that bad. I could still make cuts. But hitting it short and crooked and fearful off the tee when, it's an era when Dustin Johnson's coming out and just before Rory came out. And these guys are fearless, and they're driving it so long. And I just couldn't understand how on the range I could swing free. No problem. I had probably 20 extra, 30 extra yards on the range than I did when I got all uptight on the golf course. It's a horrible feeling to not think you can do something that you can do. It's the strangest thing. Like, I would go on the range and I would say, watch this. I can't do this. I'm going to hit a high draw. And I would hit it. And I go, look at that. I can't do that. But I did it. But you put me on the course and I couldn't. It's hard to explain the mental block. I still fight it some. I have good days and I have bad days. But, the consequence isn't quite there nowadays. I just try to, beat the fellas at Bay Hill for the most part.
Well, buddy, when you were in your late 40s, I used to egg you on all the time saying, when you hit 50, you're going to play. You're going to play. You're like, nah, I'm not going to play. Where are you now with the game? You're popping up on videos with Lee Trevino, for crying out loud.
It's much better. It's very odd. I thought, so I was turned 50 in October, and I go, well, I'm going to get in an event here and there maybe, and I don't want to suck, essentially. I don't want to finish last. That's what I kind of wanted to do. Yeah, there's my new coach, as you can see. So I thought if I come back and start working on it, I can get back to pretty good in 3 weeks, maybe 2 weeks. I was way off. I'm about 6 months into my kind of what you would call comeback, and I'm just now starting to feel like, oh, I can break par with reasonable regularity. I feel like I can control the yardage and the direction a little better. There's still some rust, but I don't think I have any goal of ever being competitive on PGA Tour Champions. I just, when I do get in, I want to play a few tournaments, and I would love to have fun, leave the course happy, not leave the course miserable because I pumped about four balls out of bounds off the tee each day.
Now, you did enter a qualifier for a PGA Tour Champions event last week. That was your first competitive tournament in a decade. What was the experience like?
I thought it would be nerve-wracking. It really wasn't. I was okay with it. It was good to see all the guys I used to play with. But I'll tell you a story, Eamon, and this is how removed I am from tournament golf. On the first tee, I walked up, and I mean this with all my heart, I had two golf balls in my hand. I had a mulligan ready to go because that's what you do at Bay Hill. You hit a mulligan off the first tee. We've always done it. And I get up to the tee, and I look, and I go, I don't need this other ball. What am I doing? And I kind of laughed and threw it back down to the cart. But I'm like, man, I am rusty. So I didn't shoot good, but I thought I played pretty good. And it gave me some promise. And again, I left the course happy. I thought that I did a pretty good job for where I was even a month ago.
Robert, among players, you were as close to Arnold Palmer as anybody. And now we see on this video with Lee Trevino, one of the best also to ever do it. What did you gain from the experience? You know, what was he helping you with, if anything?
A wedge game. He goes, if you're going to play any of these, you got to start getting those wedges close. The courses are shorter. The players are shorter. You know, they're not banging it like the guy, like John Rahm is. So, you know, you get to that 120 yards or so and in, and he's like, here's what you need to do to, you know, essentially not what you need to do, but let's try this. You know, he gave me a little tip. You saw the swing I made. I hit it perfect. And he just turned around and goes, yep, that's it. That's how easy it is. So, I would tell you what the key was, but Eamon's going to try it, and it's not going to work. And then he's going to cuss Lee Trevino, and I just can't have that.
That's probably a smart play. When you do beat Stricker and Langer, please come back and visit us, Robert. Thanks, buddy. Best of luck.
Love to. Great seeing you guys.
Arya Jutanagarn earned 25% of an LPGA Tour win at the weekend as part of Team Thailand at the International Crown. Though she does have 100% of two majors, she'll join us next from this week's Cognizant Founders Cup in New Jersey.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
On the LPGA Tour last week, it was Team Thailand that earned the title at the Hanwha Life Plus International Crown at TPC Harding Park. The team dominated Australia, sweeping all three finals matches to emerge victorious for the first time in the history of the competition. The MVP award winner, Arya Jutanagarn, chipped in on the final hole to cap the victory for her country. Let's take a look at those final scores from TPC Harding Park, with Ataya Thitakul, Patty Tavatanikit winning singles matches, and then the Jutanagarn sisters with a decisive 4-3 victory over Sarah Kemp and Minji Lee.
And quite the career Arya has put together. 2016, she took the title at the AIG Women's Open, finishing three shots ahead of runners-up Miriam Lee and Mo Martin. The victory marked her first major title. And in 2018, picked up her second major, beating Hyo-Joo Kim on the fourth hole of the playoff to win the 2018 U.S. Women's Open at Shoal Creek. In the bio, I like to use the term robust. A 12-time winner on the LPGA, twice a major champ, twice an LPGA Player of the Year, won the Vare Trophy for lowest scoring average in 2018, qualified for the 2007 Honda LPGA Thailand at age 11, making her the youngest player to qualify for an LPGA event. Arya joins us now from New Jersey. Congratulations, Arya. What made your team work so well together in San Francisco?
Well, I will say, you know, it's like so many things. We always have a really good vibe in the team. And one of our rules is like, we told everyone, like, we're only going to say like positive thing. You know, we're not going to say, oh, I missed this shot. We're just going to like say after the round, like, oh, we make this putt to win the hole. You know, this one of like, I think this one of like the key to win the last week.
Aria, your last win on the LPGA Tour was also a team event when you played with your sister. Why do you enjoy team golf so much?
I would say I'm just feel so comfortable to play with my sister because, like, I don't have to be worried about her, you know? Like, most of the time when I miss the shot, I just look at her and say, like, so what? You know, it's like, I'm not really worried because, like, it's just too comfortable to me to play with my sister.
Aria, we spoke to Atiya Titikon before the International Crown. She said there were big plans for the team to hang out after the golf, go into the city, have team dinners, find some Thai food, some Asian food. What kinds of things did you do off of the golf course together?
I will say last week we had dinner together and we do so many things together, even if we don't have much time because, like, you know, we have to play like every day, but we're hanging out and we have dinner together.
This week, Aria, you're back playing as an individual. In your last five individual events, you've two missed cuts, three top 20s. What's holding you back right now? Is it just a little bit inconsistent?
I would say everything started getting better because, like, you know, I've been working so hard since like last year. I want to get better. I want to improve like my commitment. I want to improve my swing. And I think it's getting a bit better every single week.
What are you most looking forward to this week? A golf course where you can clearly show off your talents.
I would say this golf course is one of the hardest golf course. You know, the fairway is really narrow, the green is really hard, really firm, and I think this course is really challenging because you need to drive the ball well, and also you have to have good iron to the green and be able to read the putt. So I think this course is like got everything on it.
We just mentioned how you qualified for an LPGA event when you were just 11 years old. You're still only 27, but you've been around this game for a long time. Do you still enjoy competing as much as you used to?
I would say yes, you know, and my first time on play on LPGA is when I was 11. That was like long times ago to me. I'm still enjoying it because I feel like I still have goal, I still have passion on it, and I have so many things that I want to improve to get better.
Aria, I remember speaking to your sister back in Orlando. You both came in studio one time, and you talked about who pays for dinner when you go out on the road. How do you figure out? Is Moria paying for more dinners these days, or are you picking up the check?
Honestly, we split half, but sometime when she have good week, I just let her pay. I'm not doing this.
Well, food in New Jersey can be expensive, and especially expensive if you go over to New York City. Have a great week, Aria. Congratulations on your win in San Francisco.
Thank
we'll speak
you.
To you soon.
Thank you so much.
More family talk when Golf Today returns. We're catching up with Kuchar, not the 9-time PGA Tour winner, but his son Cameron, the 15-year-old, has advanced through local qualifying and is one step closer to the U.S. Open. On Golf Today, qualifying underway for the 123rd U.S. Open next month at L.A. Country Club. The process begins with 18-hole local events conducted at 109 sites in 44 U.S. states and Canada. Now, those players who advance will join a group of exempt players in final qualifying, which will be conducted over 36 holes at 13 sites between May 16th and June the 5th. Let's take a look at U.S. Open local qualifying results as players try to qualify for golf's longest day presented by Titleist. Wellington National Golf Club played host on May 1st in South Florida. You see the name Cameron Kuchar on the leaderboard. He is the 15-year-old son of 9-time PGA Tour winner Matt Kuchar. Cameron, class of 2026 recruit, teamed up with his dad at each of the past three PNC championships. shot 369 with a bogey on the last hole to finish second and earn one of five precious final qualifying tickets out of the Wellington National Golf Club site. The course played at 7,052 yards. Cameron Kuchar joins us now. 15 years of age, what was your goal when you stuck a tee in the ground at local qualifying?
I was just trying to qualify, go out, have fun. And then it all ended up working out.
Whenever you realized you were actually in there with a chance to grab one of those five spots, Cameron, did the pressure change any? Did the nerves grow on those last few holes?
No, sir. Me and my dad always talked about just one shot at a time and just stay calm. I kind of realized on like 14 that I actually had a shot to qualify, and then I did.
Cameron, most kids think their parents don't know anything. How much do you lean on the old man for advice?
A good bit now. I used to, I could just do it, and then it's a lot easier when I have my dad help me sometimes.
Right now, your dad is eligible for that U.S. Open based on his official world golf ranking. What would it mean to you to compete in a major championship with the old man if you could get there?
I think it'd be awesome. It'd be a special moment for him and me, one we'd never forget.
You know, Cameron, we spoke to Ray Floyd Jr. recently. We spoke to Graham Rahal, the son of Bobby Rahal, the Indy 500 winner, and they said there are more benefits to being the child of a professional star as opposed to the negatives, the pressures. What's it like being the son of a nine-time PGA Tour winner?
I love it. I get to play golf whenever I want because, I mean, I'm lucky, so it's fun just to keep playing and have help from some of the best.
Cameron, you've played with your dad several times in the PNC Championship. We see you here on screen when you played with Tiger and Charlie Woods. When you've been in the middle of that kind of circus, does it make it a little easier to deal with the normal pressure situation that you would have come up against during that qualifier?
It does, because in that there's a bunch of people watching, including Tiger. But in the qualifier, it's just me and the guys I'm playing with. And me versus the course.
Well, we see you got a lot of style, you got a lot of swagger, you got a lot of game. But I know that in the Kuchar household, tennis is just as big a sport as golf is. Your younger brother plays tennis. Your dad likes tennis, your mom, grandparents. Like, how did you decide to go the golf route as opposed to the tennis route?
Well, I was a big tennis player until I was probably eight. And then I figured it's a lot of running, not really play golf.
That's a really good answer to
that
question.
That's a teenager answer, isn't it?
Has your dad given any advice for how you're going to approach this final qualifying, or how much are you going to rely on him?
He said one shot at a time is the biggest thing, not to get too far ahead of yourself, but at the end of the day, it's me hitting the shots, not him. So he can do as much as he can, but it really comes down to what I got.
Are you going to make him carry the bag for the 36 holes?
If he's here, that'd be really cool, I think. But he might be in whatever tournaments that week.
What are you working on game-wise? What needs to be sharp as you look ahead to final qualifying?
I think everything at Pine Tree, that's where the final qualifying is. It's a really tough course, I think. It involves a lot of really good iron game. So that's going to be my focus. And then around the greens, too. So iron game and short game is going to be my big thing.
Cameron, you've got the game, you've got the attitude, and you've got the dad. Best of luck, and hope you make it to the U.S. Open. Thanks for the time. Men's four-ball championship begins May 20th at the Kiawah Island Club, Cacique and River Courses. You want to talk about some sweet spots. The whole thing, the drive in there is just really, really cool. 128 sides of two golfers each with handicap indexes. A 5.4 or less, which means I'm out. They'll be reduced to 32 sides for match play following two rounds of stroke play. Let's flash back to 1 year ago at the four ball at the Country Club of Birmingham, and Drew Kittleson and Drew Stoltz went from last-minute alternates all the way to the final match, finishing runner-up. Kittleson was a former All-American at FSU who nearly defeated Danny Lee to win the U.S. Amateur. 08, Pinehurst. Drew Stoltz played his college golf at TCU and co-hosts Gravy in the Sleaze on Sirius XM with Colt Nost. And great to have the Drews with Stoltz. I want to go back to last year. That just seemed crazy, the last-minute phone call. Like, how did it all work logistically just to get into the tournament?
Yeah, you know, in Arizona, we qualified for this event so early. I think it was in September when we went out and did our qualifier, and we ended up losing in a playoff, and we became an alternate. And I think, honestly, it just kind of, like, was a race from our brains. It wasn't something that was on our radar. I remember sitting here getting ready for radio in the morning on, like, a Tuesday and getting a phone call from Kittleston being like, hey, dude, I just got an email. We just got in the four ball. And I'm like, it's in 2 days. Like, what are we going to – so there was some juggling around, you know, juggling around with schedules, things like that. As you guys know, I had to try to get a little time off of work. And then we ended up going down there, showed up the night before the first round of stroke play, didn't play any practice rounds, just went in there and, you know, just were able to play some good golf throughout the week and had a hell of a time doing it, by the way. It was fun.
Drew Kay, when you guys first paired up together, was this something you did just for casual fun, or did you actually have real competitive aspirations?
Well, you know, I don't think the competitive juices ever quite leave you. We're definitely not competitive like we used to be, but we play a lot of money games, have a lot of fun. We're very close friends, so we compete a lot. A couple of our friends made a deep run maybe a year or two before us and kind of lit a fire because they told us that we were too scared to go tee it up against them. And so it was fun. Had a blast first go. I'm looking forward to doing it again this year. Hopefully we can improve by one. But the genesis of it was just half fun, half competition.
Kittleston, on that note, what's it like to play golf living in Scottsdale? I went last year to the WM. I had lunch with Paige McKenzie at Silverleaf. There were a couple of Summer Haze kids putting on the practice green, the driving range. She's got a PGA Tour winner here and there. Just what's it like having all that access to great players and money games to keep you sharp?
Yeah, well, sharp's a good word, but sometimes you walk away with less money. you know, Drew and I are, Sleaze and I are very lucky, or I feel very lucky. I know Sleaze does to be members at, of course, Wisprock in town. And there's plenty of tour players there and plenty of action, plenty of competition, plenty of ego to run around. And we like to chirp back at people and they come back at us. Feel very lucky to do it. Beautiful golf courses, not just at Wisprock, all around town, plenty of games. It's really a golf mecca. And next time you come out, we'll take Sleaze and I'll take you out to Wisprock.
Good deal.
Yes. Good call.
Stoltz, I'm curious. I want to go back to last year for a moment. I'm curious how you guys felt after the final, having gotten in with all of that chaos, your last minute add to the field, you go so deep. What was the feeling afterwards? Was it disappointment that you didn't get it done, or was it happiness that you'd gone so far unexpectedly?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of both, honestly. You know, we weren't expecting to be in that tournament. So once we, you know, became alternates, it was, like I said, it was kind of out of sight, out of mind. And then once we got down there, got into competition, Kitty and I, you know, once the juices get going, like we show up, we want to win, and we want to win every single match that we get into. And then when we started making runs, started getting there, and especially the way that final match went, like I believe we were two up through two. We never, we didn't trail at any point during the match. We never didn't hold a lead at any point during the match until the 18th hole. They made a spectacular birdie on the 18th, like a 15, 20 footer to send it to extra holes. And really that first extra hole was really the only hole we gave away all week. I think it might've been the only bogey we made as a team. And so they were able to win it with par. I think that's what left the sour taste in our mouth, was not the fact that we lost, just the fact that we lost with, I think, our only bogey of the week on arguably one of the easier holes out there. So it also, it was a hell of a week, but also I think it kind of gave us a little motivation. Like, that was fun, man. We'd go like to duplicate that again this year.
Hey, Kittleston, if a golf fan picked up an annual of the 2009 Masters program, they'd see a picture of you in it. If they picked up a U.S. Open 2009 annual, they'd see a picture of you in it. Can you lean on those old memories from when you were competing in majors to help you in four ball?
Well, you know, it never leaves you. If to find me, you'd have to scroll pretty far down on those programs. But the you know, I had some moments in golf and things like this where people bring that up. It was a special time for me and my family. I think it's sure you can lean on it. I know it's in there. Sleaze has played amazing golf many times in his life. I've seen it happen many times. You know, I was giving Sleaze a hard time because he's got this podcast radio show thing going, but he can really play. And so it's nice to play with him because we kind of have different games, and sure, I can lean on all that. But the reality is that if I'm playing good, it's all good. And I just don't play as good as I used to as consistently. But I know it's still in there. And it's just a question if I'm going to find it or not.
Hey, Stoltz, I know Kittleson's obviously your number one choice for a partner. You host this radio show with Colton Ost. Where was he on the list? How far down do we have to go?
Oh, my God. How much time do we have? You want me to start rattling them off? Well, Colt has one thing going against him in the fact that he still has a P next to his name as opposed to an A. So he's going to have to go through a little bit of a process, a little waiting process, I would think, if he wants to re-enter the amateur game. And also, boys, I have a tendency to like partners that can hit it over 260 yards. You know what I mean? I'm a little bit biased, and Kitty can hit it about 70 yards in front of that. So that's why he's my 1A guy. Also, fun trivia fact for you guys. The last guy to make a deuce on number 11 at Augusta National in the Masters, right here. It's the toughest up and down in golf.
True story, huh, Kittleson?
True story.
That's right. My one and only claim to fame.
The bottom line is, then, the lesson, the moral of the story, don't mess with the Drews. Fellas, hope you do one better this year. Best luck on the four ball.
Thank you guys for having us. Appreciate y'all.
Thanks for having us.
Well, here's what the winners of the U.S. Amateur Four Ball receive: a gold medal, custody of the trophy for a year, a 10-year exemption into the Amateur Four Ball, exemption for each member of the side into the U.S. Amateur Cherry Hills Country Club in Colorado, and then exemptions into the junior amateur, mid-amateur, and senior amateur if age eligible.
And speaking of South Carolina, some news today. A new PGA Tour tournament, the Myrtle Beach Classic, will debut in 2024 along South Carolina's Grand Strand and will be part of the Tour's 2024 FedEx Cup regular season as a full field additional event played the same week as a designated event. $3.9 million purse with 300 FedEx Cup points to the champ, and tournament dates for the Myrtle Beach Classic will be announced at a later date along with the full 2024 FedEx Cup schedule.
My Golfweek colleague Adam Shupak is going to join us now, and Adam wrote a fascinating feature recently about the man who actually had to deal with this situation when it arose, which is Pat Riley, who was the president of the PGA of America. And Adam, you've written that Riley was the right man at that particular moment. In what way was he the right man?
Well, he had compassion. He had come from very little. He had found everything that in his life really had come from golf. He was a humble leader. He wasn't overconfident, and he understood that that this was a watershed moment and that things had to change. And while there were some people on his board who were willing to continue down the road of going to Shoal Creek, he put his foot down and said, "No way. We're pulling stakes out. We're out of here if Shoal Creek won't admit a black member before the PGA Championship begins."
Adam, was there something in Pat's background that kind of made him ready to take on this fight?
You know, there's a great story that he told me about. He grew up in Pennsylvania, and he was on a high school basketball team, and they were driving to play in the championship game. They stopped near Pittsburgh for dinner, and he saw his three black teammates sitting there and not eating. He went over to find out what was going on, and he thought maybe they just weren't hungry, but no, this was a racial situation where the owner of the restaurant wouldn't serve them. And so he went over to the owner and tried to get him to change his mind. And when he didn't, the whole team left the restaurant. And Pat was just the eighth or ninth man on this team, a junior, not the captain or, you know, star of the team. And he knew that this was wrong. And so they drove another 20 miles or so and had dinner, found somewhere where they could all eat dinner. And that was the type of guy he was. That was part of his background and turned out to be a pivotal moment, actually, in how things played out down the road, something he didn't learn for many years later.
Can you explain exactly how that became that pivotal moment in terms of the connections that were made that day and how they came to bear at Shoal Creek?
Yeah, so many years, 20 years after all of this played out, he was being inducted into his high school Hall of Fame, and one of the other inductees along with them was the sister of one of those basketball players, Charles Mitchell, and their father was a reverend, and he had called up Joseph Lowry, one of the leaders of the movement in the 60s, and who had taken up this cause, and he said to Lowry, he said, "Look, Pat Riley is someone you can trust." And you know, whether that really was the reason that everything worked out that day, Joseph Lowry agreed to go along with things when the the PGA and his organization sat down, and instead of protests, the PGA was able to go on. There was a black member admitted by Shoal Creek, and it led to so much change. So I think it was, as you guys were just saying, this really was a symbolic moment for golf and for minority participation.
But isn't it also evidence, Adam, of how embedded racism was in the game then, that even at the very time where Pat Riley was president of the PGA of America and dealing with this situation, he was himself the head professional at a golf club that did not admit blacks?
That's true. He was at Annandale in California, spent about 30 years there. And, you know, he was in a position where he could only do so much at his club. And it took some time before they did. They actually decided to let the U.S. amateur event that was going to be played there go to a different site and gave it up because they didn't want to change their rules right away and admit somebody immediately. But this had to happen. And Pat was really the guy who put his foot down. It was, you know, I think it wasn't just golf. I was thinking about this, you know, it was just a year earlier that Al Campanis, the Los Angeles Dodgers general manager, made his comments that sparked a lot of change in how Major League Baseball handled minorities and management positions. So, you know, this was really kind of the times then, and what was happening at places like Annandale wasn't all that unique, but because of this watershed moment, it led to the change that we've now had.
Adam, in 1990, the word Shoal Creek in some circles would have been considered almost like a boogeyman. How about now, though, having hosted a U.S. Women's Open, for example, in 2018, or this week hosting the PGA Works Collegiate Championship, what should Shoal Creek, what should those words mean today?
You're right. I think it's come a long way. If you had told, you know, people this 30 years ago, they probably wouldn't believe that this was happening this week. But this is a great start. And I think this event has gone to another level. I was at it a couple of years ago when they hosted it at TPC Sawgrass. And so they're continuing to bring this event to bigger locations. I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done. We still only have a few black players on the PGA Tour and in professional golf. The number of PGA Class A pros and members of, you know, there's 29,000 PGA pros, but only, I think, a little over 1,000 of them are black. So there's still a lot of room for growth. And golf has a long way still to go, but it is moving in the right direction. I think this tournament is symbolic of that.
Adam Hall Thompson, who made those incendiary quotes that Damon just read out at the start of this segment, he thought he could face down Pat Riley and Jim Autry and the PGA of America, and was refusing right until 9 days before the tournament to admit a black member. At one point in your story, you relate an anecdote where Thompson called up the secretary for Pat Riley to see how serious he was. He didn't quite get the response he was expecting, did he?
Pat Riley was as serious as cardiac arrest, and then there was just silence. And I think that was when Hall Thompson realized, you know, he tried calling the bluff, and these guys, you know, Jim Autry and Pat Riley, they were going to pull up the stakes. They were ready to go to TPC Sawgrass or some other golf course and have the PGA Championship in 1990 held anywhere but Birmingham, Alabama.
Adam, why was this a story that interested you in writing for Golf Week?
You know, that's a great question. It's probably one of the stories I wanted to write more than any story I've ever done, because I got to know Pat Riley through writing a book I did on Dean Beeman. Even though they were PGA Tour and PGA of America and clashed a lot, they learned to after the day was done, go have a meal together and became best of friends. And so I got to know Pat Riley quite well doing this book. And I'd see him at the PGA merchandise show. I'd see him at PGA championships. And he told me this story, and I wanted to write this story the very next day about what happened, because nobody knew this. And he said, he was a very modest man, and he said, "Adam, you can't write it. I'll let you write it when I die." And I mean, it was tough to have to write it, but he passed away last year, just a little over a year ago, May 4th of last year. And I spent some time talking with his family about it. They were very encouraging and helpful in coming up with a lot of the material that became part of the story. And I think it's a story he would be very proud of.
It's an important story to tell, Adam. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Anytime, guys.